Welcome to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine's Fiction Podcast. I'm EQMM's editor, Janet Hutchings. The author whose work we featured this month got his start in our Department of First Stories more than 50 years ago. Since then, he's written many short stories for us and for other publications. He's collaborated with other crime fiction authors at both short story and novel length. He's edited many anthologies, including The Misadventures of Ellery Queen, and he's one of EQMM's most prolific translators for the Passport to Crime Department. To describe Josh Pachter as a valued contributor is therefore an understatement. The author has read for our podcast series before, too. He joins us this month reading his story, The Secret Lagoon, from the September-October 2019 issue of EQMM.
This must be what hell feels like, thought Emily Monroe, as the sulfurous rain pelted her naked body. But then she reminded herself that, after 55 years as Emily Monroe, she was Emily Norton now, that today was her first day in heaven, not hell, and a smile blossomed on her upturned face. Since her first fumbling attempts as a teenager, romance had always before ended in disappointment for Emily. The high school boys had been liars, all of them, promising love but wanting only what she would do with them and for them and to them. The young college men had been no better. By the age of 30, she had resigned herself to being what her grandma Nettie would have called a spinster. But then, a year ago, one of the girls at the Cascades Library in Sterling, where she worked in the reference department, had nagged her into signing up for OurTime.com, an online dating service for men and women aged 50 and above. She had spent days struggling to write an honest profile that avoided the cliched long walks on the beach and evenings curled up before the fireplace, had spent hours snapping selfies in every decent outfit she owned until finally managing one that was a faithful representation of her appearance without being too embarrassing to post. And then had come 6 soul-crushing months of winks and pokes and superficial email exchanges that went nowhere, of boring phone conversations that made it clear a face-to-face meeting would be a waste of her time, of uncomfortable coffee dates that rarely motivated her to accept a second encounter and never once a third. Why, she wondered time and time again, are men such liars? How can they possibly think they'll get away with it? Don't they realize that the second I meet them, I'll see that their photos were taken 10 years and 30 pounds ago, that they're a decade older than they've claimed? Do they really believe I won't notice that in person they're dull and lifeless, that the fascinating hobbies and travels and careers and interests they've lured me in with are nothing but a pack of lies? She had been on the point of giving up when Jeffrey Norton had winked at her, and, like in a Hallmark rom-com or a wistful fairy tale, had swept her off her feet with his old-fashioned manners and his willingness to truly listen and, above all else, his forthrightness, his sincerity, his honesty. After a whirlwind courtship, it had been a midlife-first marriage for both of them, and Jeffrey had suggested they honeymoon in Iceland, where he had been stationed 30 years ago as a private in the U.S. Air Force. Although they had flown into Keflavik and would visit the hilltop site of the base, disestablished and returned to civilian use in 2006, on their last day in the country, after picking up their rental car, they had headed straight for Gamla Lagoon, the secret lagoon in Flyða. Once they had paid the admission charge, she and Jeffrey had separated, he off to the men's locker room, she to the women's, to neatly hang her clothing in one of the banks of free lockers and, meekly following the posted instructions, step nude into the row of showers for a thorough wash. The water was hot, and smelled of sulfur. There were 8 showerheads arranged in one long, uninterrupted line, just as she remembered from high school gym class. At least, unlike P.E., where she had been mortified to stand in the all together in the midst of a crowd of giggling girls, here she was the only person in the room, with no one to judge the toll time had taken on her too sullied flesh. Its solitude was one of the reasons they had come to Flüde, rather than heading for Grindavik, where the Blue Lagoon was not only much more famous, but also much closer to the airport. "We don't want to fight the crowds, do we?" Jeffrey had said, and she had been all too willing to agree. Jeffrey's other reason was sentiment. Although the secret lagoon was the oldest bathing pool in Iceland, it was privately owned and had, until 30 years ago, been off-limits to visitors. And Jeffrey had in fact been there for the festivities on the very first day it had opened to the public. She turned off the water and pulled on her modest one-piece swimsuit, stepped into her flip-flops and pushed open the door that led from the locker room to the lagoon. It was like tumbling down the rabbit hole into Wonderland, and any misgivings she might have had fell away from her completely, replaced by an instant enchantment with the scene that awaited her, and an instant understanding of why Jeffrey, her husband, had so enthusiastically recommended it. He was waiting for her, submerged to the chin, gazing up at Emily with a delighted grin on his dear face, wisps of steam rising around him from the green surface of the pool. "Come on in, honey," he called, relishing the corny line. "The water's fine." He pointed to one of the line of orange deck chairs, and she recognized his brightly colored blue and white striped beach towel. She dropped her matching pink and white towel on the chair beside it and gingerly slipped one flip-flopped foot into the green. It was lovely, very warm, but not too hot. 38 to 39 degrees Celsius, the internet had promised her, and Siri had obligingly converted that to 100.4 to 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit. And she eased herself into the womb-like warmth and duck-walked from the wooden steps to where Jeffrey leaned on the stone perimeter ledge. His body, she noticed, was pale, but still firm, the skin only just beginning to hint at the crepery to come. No one would ever call Jeffrey handsome, but he was a decent-looking man, and more important, he was a decent man, a good man. And most important of all, he was an honest man, her man, and she loved him with a fierceness she had feared she would never be privileged to experience. She snuggled up beside him, and he wrapped an arm around her waist. There were 2 plastic placemats on the ledge, she noticed, and she turned to him with a quizzical expression. "What are you up to?" she demanded, and his grin broadened. He straightened and waved at the back window of the building that housed the locker rooms and ticket counter and snack bar, and almost immediately a door opened and a young man in a long-sleeved white shirt and tan corduroy trousers, an absurd tam-o-shanter cap on his head and a bright red bow tie around his neck, marched toward them with a bottle of champagne, 2 crystal flutes, and a plate of smoked salmon and crackers on a silver salver in his hands. He had a bushy auburn beard and a mustache with the ends turned up and waxed, and he greeted them with a babble of what must have been Icelandic before switching to English and saying, "Welcome to the secret lagoon, Mr. and Mrs. Norton. My name is Thori, and I'll be your honeymoon concierge today." More food followed the salmon, skewered minke, a hot dog-like pilsner with mustard, sliced hangekjöt and hvera brød, and fiery shots of brennevin followed the champagne, more alcohol in one morning than Emily could remember consuming in an average month of her spinsterhood. As they ate and drank, Thori told them about Iceland, its history, its geography, its people, and especially about the secret lagoon, where he had been working for almost a year, and about which he took an inordinate pride. The more she drank, the harder it became for Emily to focus on his voice. Soon after he started in on the tale of the ghost spring. "It's a natural hot spring behind those rocks over there, 98 degrees Celsius, named for a legendary spirit who was carrying it from the Grafarbaki farm to the Reykjadalur farm, but accidentally dropped it as he was passing this place and decided to leave it where it fell." She gave up listening and busied herself trying, without Siri's help, to do the temperature conversion in her head. She thought she remembered that water boils at 100 degrees Celsius, so 98 degrees must be very close to boiling. Emily lay on her back in the pool, drifting in and out of sleep, her head kept afloat by the neon orange foam noodle behind her neck, her feet supported by a pair of neon yellow noodles, her hands on her belly holding a plastic tumbler in which a solitary ice cube floated in 2 inches of coke like a glacier bobbing gently in the sea. Her eyes were closed. The geothermally heated water bathed her, soaked away the jet lag and the alcohol and the tension her muscles might otherwise have felt. Jeffrey had cautioned her that the Blue Lagoon could hold 1,000 visitors at a time and was often filled to capacity. But the Secret Lagoon, though not really a secret, was off the beaten track and would be far less populated. Sure enough, she could hear the murmur of a whispered conversation in a language she couldn't place off to her left. And to her right, 2 children splashed and chattered despite their parents' efforts to shush them. But that was all. 12 guests at most, all occupied with their own enjoyment and paying her not the slightest attention. She dozed off again, but startled awake when a voice called her name. She opened her eyes and saw Thori standing at the edge of the pool, waving her over. She kicked away the noodles and stood, the water reaching only to her chest. "Mrs. Norton," the young man called more loudly, his hand urgently chopping the air. "Please." She waded over to him, and he helped her up onto dry land. She stood there, dripping, her eyes darting from side to side. "Where's Jeffrey?" she said, her voice taut. "Where's my husband?" "I need you to come with me," Thori instructed her. "I'm afraid there's been an accident." He set off up the path that ringed the lagoon, leaving her no choice but to follow in his footsteps. "Where are we going?" she shouted after him. "The ghost spring," he said, neither breaking his stride nor looking back. They turned a corner and came in sight of it. Sure enough, its deep green surface bubbled with heat. A man's body lay face down and motionless in the center of the spring, just far enough from the path to be out of reach. It was wearing Jeffrey's swim trunks. A long moment passed, and then Emily Norton screamed. The name on the plainclothes detective's identification card read B. Sigurðardóttir, but the woman had introduced herself exactly as described in the Arnaldur Indriðason novels Emily had read in preparation for this trip, by her first name only, as Björkildur, and had led her from the plastic chair in the snack bar where she had spent the last hour alternately weeping and completely numb, back out along the path to the ghost spring. She had the stereotypically Nordic peaches and cream complexion, the black eyes and long, straight, ash-blonde hair Emily had seen again and again in the promotional videos she'd watched on the small television screen set into the back of the seat in front of hers on their Icelandair flight from Dulles. But the broad, toothy smile was missing, replaced by a serious, narrow-lipped frown more appropriate to the tragedy she was there to investigate. "When was the last time you saw your husband?" Björkildur asked, not looking up from her pen and notepad. She thought back. Thori, she pronounced it Thori, which was as close as an American palate could come to the sound of the unique Icelandic consonant, had just refilled our glasses and gone back inside to prepare a plate of, I can't remember what it was called, some kind of shark, I think he said. Kesturhakar, the detective supplied, still not raising her eyes from her notes. Fermented shark. You would have hated it. It's got the very strong smell of ammonia. Emily pulled a face. He said it would take half an hour before it was ready, and Jeffrey decided to walk around the pool. He asked me to go with him, but I was dizzy from the champagne and brennavine, so I told him to go without me. And then he went, and I watched him until I lost sight of him behind the rocks. You didn't see him again? Not until... And she cupped her hands before her face and breathed into them. It was almost a minute before she was able to compose herself enough to continue. Not until Thorey came and told me to come with him. There'd been an accident. Accident? The scruffy man from the medical examiner's office said, glancing up from where he squatted over Jeffrey's body. Have a look at this, Bjorgilder. The detective hunkered down beside him. She had seen the dead man's face, scalded red by the almost boiling water of the spring, when they'd fished the body out with a grappling hook and laid it on a rectangle of white plastic that had been spread on the path. But the doctor now pointed to the back of Jeffrey's head, and Emily could see that her husband's thinning fringe of hair was clotted with blood. Bjorkhildr looked up at her. This was no accident, she said, rising. He's been hit hard at the base of the skull. Emily's breath caught in her throat. Are you saying? I'm saying he was murdered. Couldn't it have happened when he fell? Not possible, the doctor said flatly. It looks to me like the blow either killed him outright or at least knocked him unconscious. If he hit his head when he fell, we would have found him lying face up, not face down. Was he carrying anything of value? Asked Bjorkhildr. Anything someone might have wanted to steal? Emily considered the question. I don't think so, she said at last. I think he must have left his wallet in a locker in the changing room, like I did. I'm not sure, but you can check. That's the locker key on that stretchy thing around his wrist. I have one, too. She raised her left arm to display it. Do you know anyone in Iceland? Anyone who might have had the reason to attack your husband? She shook her head. I certainly don't. I've never been here before this morning, but I suppose it's possible that Jeffrey might have. He was stationed in Keflavik with the Air Force 30 years ago. 30 years is a long time to hold a grudge, the detective mused. But still. Jeffrey's wallet and passport were, in fact, found in his pants pocket, in the locker where he had left his clothing, and their rental car sat where they had parked it, apparently undisturbed. When, after more than 3 hours, they had finally taken Emily's contact information and allowed her to leave the scene, she hadn't known where else to go, so she'd followed their GPS's directions past the infamous Eyjafjallajökull volcano to the Hotel Skugar, almost an hour and a half to the southeast. It was nearly impossible for her to pay attention to her driving, but there was practically no traffic on the four-lane highway, and she simply did what the computerized voice told her to do, oblivious to the magnificently desolate scenery on either side of the road. There was no way she could possibly eat anything, not now. But she had asked the receptionist to pour her a glass of red wine and had carried it to her room. From the window, she could see the majestic Skugafoss waterfall half a mile away, could hear it roar until she closed the window and latched it. Overcome with emotion and exhaustion, she dropped onto the bed fully clothed, the wine untouched on the night table beside her, and tried not to think of Jeffrey's body stretched out on that white plastic sheet on the path beside the ghost spring. Outside the window, darkness did not fall. Later, She glanced absently at her wrist and saw to her surprise that it was almost 12, though the sky remained a lovely pale blue. The land of the midnight sun, she thought. Or was that Norway? She dragged herself out of bed to close the blackout curtains, then lay down again, and this time, her hand trembling, took a small sip of her wine. It was made from crowberries, the receptionist had told her. It was rich in antioxidants. She tasted nothing. It was like drinking air. And now, Jeffrey, her husband, was dead. What was she supposed to do next? Alone, 3,000 miles from home, 55 years old, and both a bride and a widow in the same week. Their honeymoon, of course, was over. In the morning, she would cancel their reservations in Kirkjubeyarklaustur and Hveragerði, which Jeffrey had told her the airmen on the base had jokingly called Hurdy-Gurdy and Reykjavik. Perhaps one day she would return to Iceland to drive the Golden Circle, to see the Thingvellir National Park and Geysir and the Gullfoss waterfalls, the black sand beaches at Vik and the Jökulsárlón glacial lagoon and Diamond Beach. But for now, she would sit here in Skogar and wait until the police had concluded their investigation, and then she would return home to Northern Virginia, to her dead-end job as Marion the librarian, and figure out what to do with the rest of her life. If only she hadn't gone into the snack bar that morning, after Jeffrey had set off on his walk. But her head was still spinning from the unaccustomed morning drinking, and she needed something non-alcoholic to wash away the taste of the liquor. "Are you enjoying your visit, ma'am?" the girl behind the counter inquired. "Oh, yes," she said, "very much so." "Is this your first time at Gamla Loden?" "Mine, yes, but my husband's been here before. He was here the day you opened to the public." "That was before I was born," the girl smiled. "But I've certainly heard about it from my mum and dad." "Are they the owners?" "Yes, the lagoon's been in our family for generations. They were both here that first day. They've told me many times about the opening. And, of course, about the woman who died."
"Died?" The girl glanced conspiratorially around the room.
"We're not really supposed to talk about it," she said. "But yes, a woman died that very first day. She fell into the ghost spring and was scalded to death. The police suspected her husband had pushed her, but they were never able to prove anything. Officially, it was ruled an accident, but my parents were convinced the husband killed her."
"Were they Icelanders?" Emily asked, her heart suddenly pounding in her chest.
"No, tourists. Americans, I think. The husband was stationed at the Navy base in Keflavik."
"A sailor, then?"
"Oh, I'm not sure, but I think he was in the Air Force. You'd have to ask my dad."
But Emily didn't ask. Instead, she took her Coke and, her head still swimming from the alcohol, returned to the lagoon. The couple and their raucous children were gone, and the place was now nearly deserted. Jeffrey had not yet returned from his walk, and she went off in search of him. He had never been married before, he told her.
Had he lied? She was his first and only love, he had promised her. So he had lied about that as well. The thought that he had perhaps murdered his first wife barely entered her mind. What mattered was that he had lied. He had lied to her like all the rest of them. Without conscious thought, she bent over, almost swooning from the wave of nausea that engulfed her, and picked up a rock that lay by the side of the path. It was warm to the touch, and it seemed to have been carved by time to the exact size and shape of her hand.
The Secret Lagoon is copyrighted by Josh Pachter. Music for the podcast was obtained from purpleplanet.com. Mixing and editing for the podcast were done by Ray Purdom and Jackie Sherbo. You can subscribe to Ellery Queen's Mystery Magazine, where you'll find more stories like this one, by visiting our website at www.ellerycueenmysterymagazine.com.